having sex with someone is super, super satisfying in the moment. But having sex with 100 different people on 100 days, at the end of all of that, are those people truly happy? Usually, ultimately, not. And that's based on actual evidence. Hedonism is what our bodies tell us we want. But in truth, it isn't actually what makes human beings happy.
Hello, friend, and welcome to the Sex Upgraded Podcast, a podcast for men all about sex, where we'll combine real, authentic, and down-to-earth conversations about sex, life, and relationships with some pretty wild personal stories and practical how-to episodes as well, with guest experts from around the world to help you have the most amazing sex life you can possibly have. My name is Taylor, and I'll be your host on this journey. And it's my goal with each episode to give you practical, actionable things you can start doing today to improve your sex life and your entire life. Because a thriving sex life will help you thrive in all areas of your life. So let's begin today's episode by starting with a deep breath in through the nose into the belly together. Exhaling with an audible sigh. And let's get into today's episode. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a little while. Today, I am joined by Ricky Aronson, who is an endocrinologist, who is also an author, who's apparently also a stand-up comedian. And you've done a lot of look into couples dynamics, relational dynamics. You've talked about how to have amazing sex at home, even if there are kids there. You've talked about why couples fight, how to have better, harmonious long-term relationships. And I'm excited to get into all that stuff and a whole other list of questions that I have for you. But before we do, is there anything else you'd like to add to that list to sort of introduce yourself and give listeners a context of where you're coming from?
That's fantastic. Thanks, Taylor. It's an absolute honor to join you. Yes, my background is I'm an endocrinologist and a geriatrician. Geriatrician is also a care of the elderly. So I do two different specialties, and both of them really give a lot of insight into relationships, because on the one hand, endocrinology deals with hormones, and within that construct, a lot of couples have problems when there are hormonal issues. And often what happens is that couples present with a medical issue that turns out to be a relationship problem. So people think that their libido or their sex issues are related to hormones, but actually it turns out to be psychological or relationship related. And at the other end of the scale, looking after very much older patients, you get to see really, I think, the benefits of long-term happy relationships, because the patients of mine that are the happiest who present in their older years are the ones who are married, and they present together holding hands, and it's something actually quite beautiful. So I guess I get a broad perspective on that. And also just as an introduction to what I do, one of the reasons why I've ended up in the place I have is that I've done a huge amount of work in medical leadership within the medical profession to try and teach doctors how to manage people better. And in the path that I've taken, I've ended up running a lot of courses on managing people and relationships. And that really was the path that led me to write the book, because it's an unusual place to end up as a doctor, I think, to be writing about relationships. But it's actually what we all do. No matter what profession you're in, you deal with people and relationships, and that makes or breaks your happiness and success.
Totally. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, hearing you share all that, thank you. It reminds me, I forget which university it was, but there was this massive study that was done that looked at, you know, what's the biggest determiner of long-term health and happiness, and it was the quality of relationships that people had. I think it had a lot to do with friendships and close connections, but, you know, romantic relationships are right up there as well. It's also interesting to hear you say the piece about how couples will present thinking they have a medical hormone issue, and then it's actually a relational piece. A few months ago, I like to share personal anecdotes on this podcast. I bought a house with my partner this past year, and it was beautiful and amazing. And we moved in, and it was also stressful, and we renovated things, and I went through a period of burnout. And I thought, you know what? I'm 38. Lots of people are talking about testosterone. Probably I just need to boost my testosterone and everything will be fine. I got tests. Long story short, I was just stressed. all my hormone levels supposedly were fine. And it was just like, wow, it was a good, it's a good wake up call. So thanks for that confirmation. Well, Maybe I'll ask you a question about testosterone later.
I'll answer both those statements. The first thing is you were referring to the Harvard study of adult development, which is the longest running study on human happiness. And that's a fascinating study because what it shows is not just that long-term relationships produce happier people. It also shows that long-term, healthy, happy relationships produce healthier people. So actually the path to being healthier and happier is forming long-term relationships, which is fascinating. And also showed that people who integrate well into communities and who are in long-term happy relationships are the people who live the longest and are the happiest, which I think intuitively we all kind of get that. The second part of what you were asking about testosterone is kind of also a challenging aspect of practicing endocrinology, because I have a huge number of patients who present either with chronic fatigue or with low libido, all alleging that it's hormonally related. And there's this preoccupation in the world with hormones. It's fascinating, but nobody wants to believe that they can take ownership of their own lives, that maybe they should get more sleep, do some relaxation, reduce their stress, work on their relationship, you know, stop fighting with everyone. And that will make them happier, healthier, and less stressed. No, it's always hormones. So all that I see of, not all that I see, but a lot of what I see are people who are tired and who say it's my hormones. And actually, it's their lifestyles. It's their approach. So I will relate my own anecdote. It's actually in my book, but I think it relates well to what you were saying. So I saw a guy who came in and he said to me, I've got low testosterone. So I said, okay. So I was doing a history. His wife was sitting there. She looked quite an angry type. I was a bit scared of her myself. I said to him, well, you know, how often do you have sex? He said, never. I said, oh, okay, why? So he goes, well, we've got kids. If you had four kids, you'd understand. And I actually did have four kids, by the way, at the time, but I didn't say that because it's never good to tell patients stuff like that. So his wife got quite angry and she goes, yes, we've got four kids. How are we supposed to have sex? So I said to them, well, many couples with four kids are still having sex. And they went, ooh, do you think our friends are doing this? I said, yeah, probably. Most of them, yes. And they looked at me like I was crazy. And they went, but you don't understand. We've got four kids. What if they walked into the room? I said, have you ever heard of a lock on the door? Now, I know you're sitting there thinking, Taylor, you think this guy's a genius. I mean, how does he come up with these kinds of answers for patients? But, you know, we learn the stuff at medical school. There's a whole lecture called The Lock on the Door. So this whole conversation went on, and they kind of got quite – as the conversation went on, they got less and less angry, and they started to become quite excited. And by the time they left, they were going to put a lock on their door. Oh, the one thing they said to me, they said, but what if your children know what you're doing behind the locked door? So I said to them, you know, it's quite normal. Although it's a very uncomfortable idea, everyone has to reach the realization at some point of their lives that their parents must have had sex for them to exist. And we are designed to be okay with that. It doesn't cause psychological damage because that's what the life cycle is. So they went away and they came back very, very excited. And they wanted to tell me all the lurid details of what they were up to. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm a doctor. I'm very happy that I fixed your problems, but there's stuff that even I don't need to know, TMI. So they went away happy. But that was an example of where people are talking about testosterone, but really the issue was just, I don't even know if you call that a relationship issue. It's just a very unusual, you know, idea that they'd got in their heads they couldn't get rid of.
Totally. Well, I mean, I can only empathize without knowing what it's like to have four children of all the stress and all the ideas that might get stuck in your head when you have that going on. But I think that's a good segue into the question, like, say you are somebody with kids at home, young kids. A lot of my really close friends are new parents right now. Like, how do you continue to have, I mean, yeah, how would you advise other patients? Like, is it always put a lock on the door? You know, what would... Like, what would you say on this topic? Like, how do you have really good sex if you have kids at home?
Well, I think that's a very broad question, because as your children are different ages, I think the approach is very different. So the first thing is, I've just written another book, which is not available yet. It's still going to take a while to get it to the publication process, about parenting. And my chapter on infancy is called Make a Pact to Survive, which is basically the best that you can aim for with a newborn baby is usually survival. And pretty much everything else is of lesser consequence, because you're not getting any sleep. It's a huge, it's a huge undertaking, the 24/7 needs of a baby. But nevertheless, the thing about sex is that it requires commitment and investment. And so what I advise everyone, no matter what age your kids are, is to put aside protected time. And that, I think, is the most important thing, is that a couple find time to spend together. And that's not just about sex. It's about friendship. It's about discussion. It's about intimacy. And intimacy is very, very important. And it's about sex. Yeah. So I think that the first thing to say is that if you stop putting aside time for sex and you stop prioritizing it, then it's going to fall by the wayside, because it's not on the to-do list. So my advice in that setting is, firstly, sex remains important for many people despite having a baby. I can speak for many men that I know that their libidos are quite bulletproof, and that you can, go without sleep for 10 days and, go fight in a war and come back, and all that you actually want is to have sex. So that's something which having a baby doesn't affect for many men. And so if that gets neglected, then you are risking, if either partner is really wanting to have sex, is risking both partners becoming frustrated and relationship issues. So whether you've had a baby or not, I think putting aside protected time, keeping sex on the agenda. So there's two things I would say to that as well. And it doesn't matter what age your kids are. The first is that when things fail in life, the one thing you can always go back to is routine. So I think that if you are not having sex anymore, the only way that you can have good sex is if you start having sex again. If you never have sex, you're not going to have good sex. I know that's pretty true. So the first thing you can start to do is to sit down and say, we'd like to have sex. We're not finding time to do it, and that's a problem. So we are going to set aside this particular time slot every week, once a week, twice a week, whatever you as a couple decide. Let's say Wednesday night, we go to bed early, we have sex every single Wednesday night without fail, and you make sure you do that. And then you can make that special. You can light candles, you can put on music, you can go out for dinner before, and whatever you want, date night, not date night. And even if you have a baby, you can get a babysitter. You can do it however you want to do it, but you put aside that time, and you know Wednesday night is business time, so to speak. Now, that's not the ideal ultimate expression of a sex life, in the sense that spontaneity is very positive. And it's very nice if you can also suddenly feel in the mood, look at each other and go, wow, you're looking nice today. And then both of you go, wow, this is a great time. And I think there's a magic to that. But if you don't put aside protected time, you may stop having sex altogether. And everything in life is a habit. You want to keep yourself sexually active. You want to be thinking about it. You want to be intimate. You want to be touching each other. You want to be affectionate. And you want to keep having sex, because the moment you stop doing it, then I'll give you an analogy that's interesting. Even in medicine, I've been practicing medicine for over 20 years, almost 25. Mm-hmm. No, wait, I'm getting old. 25 years. Wow. And I feel so young. But even with medicine, if I stop doing a particular aspect of my role and then I need to go back to it, it becomes harder and harder and more of an issue. So there's certain things that I don't do clinically anymore, but I did them for a long time. And when I go to do it, sometimes we rotate, we do different things, and I start doing something I haven't done for a while, I'm actually very anxious about it, even though I might have done it a million times. And then when you start doing it, you suddenly realize, hey, I know how to do this. It's like riding a bike. I've done this a million times. It's just the same as before. Mm-hmm. I'm okay. So I think you can do that with your sex life if you create performance anxiety. And also, you make such a big deal out of it if you remove it from your routine and it becomes something which both partners just starts building up because you haven't done it for so long. And then what if you don't enjoy it? And what if it doesn't work so well? So I think it's really, really important to stay in the habit.
Yeah. And I'll share that sometimes for people, in those contexts, like say you make the date, you come to the date and you're like, oh, I don't feel like having sex, I'm stressed, et cetera. So my partner and I, what we do, because we went through some of that last year, was that we would set dates to come together without cell phones on, without distractions, that sort of a thing. Mind you, we don't even have kids, but we would do that. And the agreement was that we were going to get naked and be in our bodies and maybe move to music, maybe dance. We weren't necessarily 100% have to going to have sex per se, but just the simple commitment of being naked together and touching in bodies and being without distractions would usually lead to sex. And it was like that was kind of like getting the foot in the door. So that's helpful for me now to think about that of like, okay, say you make a sex date. Well, like sometimes it can feel like a lot of pressure. So maybe you just make like a naked hangout, be in bodies date. And sometimes that can open the door to actual sex. Yeah. At least for me, that was helpful. And I also do really like the planning it. You know, I think it's useful. You know?
Well, the answer that you've just given is actually a textbook answer, because if you look at any sex therapy, well, most mainstream sex therapy advice and what people actually, what sex therapists do with people when they are having sexual issues, if they have anxiety, is the first thing they do is tell them exactly what you've very sensibly said, which is that you can focus a bit less on the actual act of coitus, let's call it, the actual sexual act itself of penetration, yeah, and focus more on sharing pleasure, on intimacy, on being close together. And that, even if you don't end up having sex itself, there is great benefit from being intimate. Giving each other pleasure is something fantastic. I mean, pleasure is very nice. And sharing pleasure with someone that you love is nice. Receiving it is nice. So even if the worst outcome, yeah, is that you share a whole lot of pleasure and you're close together, that's a fantastic outcome. And as you've correctly said, generally that'll take the pressure off and lead to people having sex naturally anyhow. So that's just good therapy advice you've just given there.
Hey, well, hopefully there's a reason I'm in this career right now. So I like how you added the context of survival mode for new parents. And just actually earlier this week, I was on a coaching call with somebody who has an 8-month-old, and he was very much in survival mode. And I was just saying, you know, this is normal. Like, this is natural. As a non-parent, I've heard many parents say that. I'm curious in your perspective, for anybody who's in 6 months in, 8 months in, a year in, where do you generally, does the survival mode start to taper into, okay, now you can have something other than survival mode generally?
Yeah, look, I think one of the problems with modern parents is that we have a generation of dysfunctional, dyscopic parents, to be quite honest. And that's one of the reasons why I've written my next book, is to talk about how do we get better. Because previous generations of parents didn't feel that they couldn't cope with parenting. They coped. And they actually didn't stop. I mean, I've got a lot of friends who are, particularly my 25, 30-year-old friends, who tell me they can't leave the house because they've got kids. They can't do this because they've got kids. And you see that, unfortunately, it filters into relationships. People start to say, well, we can't have sex because we've got kids. You know, we've got no time for each other. Well, it's all about the kids. The problem with that philosophy is that it actually isn't. It's actually as much about you. Because if your relationship, whether you're same-sex or married couple or whatever your relationship, is the fulcrum of the family. And if that relationship breaks down, the whole family's in trouble. And kids are entirely reliant on the unity of their parents for good parenting and also for their emotional well-being. And we know that when couples divorce, separate with kids, it's a very, very damaging event for the kids. So this idea that, oh, we must just give everything to the kids and not worry about ourselves isn't actually selfless. It's actually misguided, because if you don't keep working on your relationship, that is going to affect the kids. If you're fighting, if you're not getting along, if they don't see that love between their parents, it's actually very damaging to them, and it's much more worthwhile to keep that going. You can do both. Humans have a capacity to love endlessly, and you can love your partner, you can make time for them, and you can love your children and make time for them. So I'm very, very opposed to this idea that you can make this excuse, oh, it's all about the kids, we don't have time for each other, because that's actually bad for the kids. But in answer to your question of when does the survival mode end, I guess that's a very broad and general question to something that's very specific in life. The real difficulty with babies is they require 24/7 care. So, you know, in most cases, mothers are breastfeeding, and whether they're breastfeeding and there's some bottle feeding or not, that baby requires 24/7 care. And that does complicate the amount of quality time you can spend with your partner. And for some husbands, I find particularly, that can be more difficult because husbands are used to having their wonderful nurturing wives taking care of them like a baby. And then suddenly the wife really has to take care of the baby like a baby, and the and they're hoping that their husband will step up and actually be a mature adult and help them, because they really need the emotional and physical support. So that stage is very, very difficult for anyone. And there is a certain survival aspect when women are, or men as well, if men are good and they're getting up and feeding the baby at night. Everyone's sleep deprived. It's often at a time of career where whoever's working is actually still trying to establish themselves, because people are usually having babies often earlier or in the middle of their careers, not when they're, you know, really, really established. And you're fighting for financial and physical survival with your back aching and no sleep and a crying baby. And that's the next part is actually also pretty hard, because once babies become toddlers, they crawl around everywhere sticking things in their mouths and trying to kill themselves permanently. They're like a suicide machine. You know, you turn around, they're on the ledge trying to jump out the window. Yeah. Then you turn around and they've got drinking a bottle of drain cleaner. So, you know, that requires, and that's in a way is almost worse, because with a baby, you can kind of drop them on a mat in the middle of the room, go to the bathroom, you're fine. With a toddler, you can't drop them on a mat and go to the bathroom. They'll be halfway down the road, probably, you know, hitchhiking to Cincinnati by the time you come out. I think for the first 2 years, that is the really, really, really tough time. After 2 years, if you're a good parent, and I don't think many parents manage this well anymore, you should be managing a controlled house. Like, that's your job as a parent. You're a manager of the house. So you need to take control of your house, and your kids should be in some way behaving in a way that allows you to not be in survival mode. And if you're still in survival mode and your kids are 5 and 6 years old, I believe that reflects on you as a manager, because you're, in other words, you're not managing your household. So that's a management issue. And that's really, I think, where our generation of parents are struggling to understand the role of manager that they require.
Yeah. So if we could just go meta for a second, why do you think that this, do you have any ideas, like, why do you think this particular generation is having some of those struggles compared to previous ones?
That's fascinating. And I think there's many, many reasons. The first is there are things that we face as a generation that our parents didn't. And that is, there are real challenges in that. The one is that many parents are working, both parents are working. Whereas my parents and many of my friends' parents, the dad worked and the mom stayed at home. So there's a lot more pressure on a couple when both partners are working. And that's not to discourage women from working. My wife's also a doctor, so I definitely don't discourage that. But just to say that in reality, having both parents working and the added pressures of people writing exams and qualifying for various things and, you know, fighting in their own career, it certainly takes up a big piece of your soul when you're doing that. And there's less than for everything else. And that's just reality. Mm-hmm. So for couples, they're often managing both partners' careers as well, which is a big extra dimension. Mm-hmm. I think as well as that, there is a gender role issue which has become very political, but I'd rather look at it rather as a functional and practical issue. And that is, most modern women, or many certainly in the first world, want their husbands to stand up and help at home, and they expect them to. So you don't have these sort of slave wives running around washing all the dishes, you know, putting out the guy's slippers when he comes home from work, because the wives are also working. So there's a lot of pressure. I think there are many other factors, though. The one is, we as a generation live in times that are extremely confused morally and very confused also in terms of our philosophies. So whereas our parents grew up in a generation where people actually understood what was right and what was wrong, we live in this time where everything goes, and as long as you feel good, that's all that counts. And the problem is, the consequence of that is actually nobody feels good. And one of the reasons for that is narcissism actually doesn't lead to happiness. So people, when they're worrying about themselves all the time, they're unhappy. Why? Because we know from the evidence we discussed earlier that relationships are the key to happiness. And how do relationships work? Mm. They're about caring about someone else. So when people start to regard giving as hard work and suffering, they start becoming unhappy, and it puts a lot of pressure on what they're doing. Because if you regard giving as being what you should be doing and your role, you can actually take pleasure in it. So giving to your partner sexually is a pleasure for you because you want to give to your partner. You love them. Giving to your job, giving to your children, you feel, this is what I want to do. I understand that life is about hard work. So I think one other big issue is a philosophical issue that people now regard hard work as a punishment, not a necessity. And as well as that, we as a generation seem to have reacted in a very strong way to the fact that society for a long time went too far the other way. There was far too much caning of children, discipline at school, parents smacking their children, children being ordered to sit in the corner quietly and not have an opinion. And that was obviously too far the other way. So now as a reaction to that, I think the pendulum has swung too far the other way now, where children are the managers of their house. They call all the shots. They scream and cry until their parents give them what they want. And their parents have no idea how to handle that and just throw toys and money and whatever they want and iPhones at them. And clearly humans need boundaries and consequences to run a civil society. That's what civilization is. It's a society that runs with a set of civil rules, and we are actually bound by them. And rules are not a bad thing, and that's where I think our generation is reacting against rules. But rules are good, because if you go on a tennis court and just smack a ball around, it's no fun. It's the rules that make it interesting. If everyone just steals from each other and punches each other in the face, then life is horrible. So it's when you're in a relationship, if you cheat on your partner, if you don't obey certain, acceptable civilized rules in a relationship, the relationship breaks down. So I think this is where we've gone wrong. Is we've gone so far the other way, where everything goes and it's all about how I feel, and as long as I feel good, that's the important thing. It's actually not. There's a lot more to life than just feeling good. And ultimately, if you just pursue feeling good, which is hedonism, you actually probably end up unhappy. That's a very long answer to a simple question.
It is. It is. And you raised a lot of really interesting directions that we could go down. Just to hit on one of them, I think part of this, and you didn't name it, but there's this whole social media trend in the modern world, which is like, share all your life, share all your positive things, document everything, like make this whole like self positive world facing profile that showcases your best moments and share all that with the world, and really just like self, hyper individualistic mentality that creates some of that separation too. And I can imagine knowing some of my friends who are parents, like in that survival phase, there is less energy and there's less willpower and there's just like more chaos and more stress. And in that time, social media can be an easy, quick outlet that can seem like it's giving you stimulation. But then in the process, it actually might be making you more isolated, which might be a compounding effect. I'm just sort of thinking out loud here. But I really like how you said that piece of like, well, actually, just focusing on the self and making the self happy isn't actually the thing that creates long-term happiness necessarily. You know, it's about connecting with others more. And building.
So social media is I think one of the greatest threats to civilization that we've ever seen. And I'm not overstating that. I think the whole, in everything that we do in life is regulated. So, if you are, your accountant is regulated strictly by a set of regulation rules, and doctors are regulated and everyone's regulated. And the only thing that's not regulated is the internet. And so that's a very interesting statement when you consider how influential it's become. So I've actually done a whole podcast on this. It's not available yet, but I've called it the most important subject in the world, because you're quite right. We have this massively influential tool that's in everyone's brains all the time. And we're really, as a society, haven't come to terms with how much that's changed the world. And so 20 years ago, people went on dates and held hands and looked into each other's eyes lovingly. Now people go on dates and they hold their phone and look at their screen while they're on a date. And when, kids are sitting in the playground, they're texting each other, sitting next to each other. And then we have this massive, very inflammatory social media, which is designed to make people unhappy and angry. I don't think people know that. And that's, I think, something that I've been trying to advertise and work on in the world. I know I'm not the only one. I'm not claiming to be. I know lots of people, Sacha Baron Cohen's example. There are lots of people out there who are talking about this. But the issue is the big companies in the world, the biggest corporations, the wealthiest corporations make money by keeping you on your screen. That's how they make money. The moment you turn off your phone and go and have sex, they're not making money. The moment you go for a walk in a forest and turn off your phone, they're not making money. So they need to find ways as their actual business plan to addict you to your screen and keep you there. And one of the things we know is that if someone drives past a pretty flower, they don't stop and look. But if someone drives past a car accident, the worse it is, the longer people look. That's been studied in psychological studies. It's obvious. The internet understands that. So companies like Apple and Google and Facebook and all these companies are actually intentionally putting sensationalist and often quite angry media in your children's and your face all the time because they want you to watch it. And they know that that's the kind of stuff that humans are attracted to. So we're creating this very angry, divided generation. And it's and your subject on sexuality and relationships is very affected by this, because making people angry and divided is very bad for relationships. And making people narcissistic is very bad for relationships, which are all about giving, not what's in it for me, but actually what's in it for my partner. So if both partners focus on the needs of the other, you have a happy relationship.
I've been toying around with the idea of making a meme, an internet meme. Sometimes that's just where my creative brain goes, a little side note. And one of them is so I'll go out to different parks, different places outdoors in nature, and it seems like people are happy outside. People are talking to each other. People are having a good time. And then you turn on the news or you turn on the internet and it's like everyone fucking hates each other and everyone's screaming at each other. And the news would have you convinced that the world is about to end any second. It's because the other side is bad and stupid. Meanwhile, if you just go out in real life, people are actually getting along with each other. And a lot of times people are able to have conversations with different frames of view. And so, yeah, that's just like, you're right on to that. And also it's the whole illusion thing. So with my account, there are probably people out there who think all I think about is sex. All I think about is sex. All I do is have sex. I must be having orgies all the time. I must be having anal sex constantly. I must be doing like all the things I specifically have created an educational career around. People personalize it because it's really the only thing on my page because I'm trying to be a resource. But they're like, man, Taylor is obsessed with sex. I want to be like, actually, in my life, I do a lot of other things besides have sex to live a healthy lifestyle. And it's just interesting how we can project all that based on a social media profile. And nobody's social media profile is an accurate depiction of what's actually happening in their life, you know? So I know this is a whole other rabbit hole, but I just wanted to say that, yeah.
No, I'm very with you on all of that. And I think that one of the greatest sadnesses for me is you would have got already that I'm incredibly opposed to identity politics. I think it's the opposite of what the world needs. And I think the real tragedy is that, and you'd experience this particularly in America, is that I believe the world was actually headed in a very positive direction 10 years ago. When I grew up in apartheid South Africa, South Africa was very, very racially charged growing up, and understandably. And we understood that what we wanted was to unite people. That was our goal, for white and black people to be together of all colors, all shapes, sexes, sizes, sexuality. It doesn't matter whether you straight, gay, black, white, whatever. The idea was we come together and we're all human. And when we sit and talk to each other, we get to know what makes the other person tick. And we recognize, hey, they're a human being just like me. They're the same, you know, hang-ups and vulnerabilities. And we all want to be valued. We all want to care about each other. And you find common ground and you see the humanity in each other. And so that was where we were headed. Now we have a world, and I believe social media and the internet's played a big part in this, where everything is about being angry with each other. It's all like, if you are this color or that color or this sexuality or this gender, we have to fight. And you look at a lot of what's of offense, as they call it. Everything is offensive. Conversation is offensive. I mean, we're all going to say things. If we express opinions, we're going to offend each other. And that isn't a bad thing. Because we should be having conversations. We should offend each other. And then having done that, we can talk about, look, if I can't offend you, you also can't tell me what offends you. And I want to know, have a reasonable discussion with you and say, hey, I'm actually not meaning to offend you when I say that. What I'm saying is this. And you go, hey, I was very offended by it, but now when I see where you're coming from, you know, I see that actually isn't what you meant. But when you say those kinds of things in that way, that hurts my feelings. And then I go, hey, that wasn't what I meant to say. I can learn from that, that, you know, I'm coming from this direction, but I need to be a bit more sensitive in how I put that across. If you can't have those conversations, all you have is everyone hating each other and getting more and more offended, which is where we're at the moment. And you're quite right. I think it's incongruous with where people want to be, because I do believe, living in Australia, for example, most people here really, really don't care whether people are white, black, straight, or gray, gay. They really, really don't care. They're happy to be friendly with anyone. They're happy to get on with other people. And then they have the social media telling them, no, you all have to dislike each other, which I think is just so sad.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So there's so many different rabbit holes we could go down with that. And I want to circle it back to the relationship piece, just because of the general topic. But yeah, it's a wild world we're living in right now. And I think what happens too is that many of us are getting subconsciously programmed and oriented towards conflict and holding our own perspective, even in the context of our own relationship. So like you said, you know, based on people's differences, perhaps like sexual orientation wise or ethnicity, whatever, even in the context of romantic relationship with partner, it's so easy for myself or my partner or one person to say, I'm right, you know, or like you hurt me, and not actually have that discourse and that conversation and be able to, I think that's one of the biggest skills and strengths and capacities that people need to develop in relationship, is actually to be able to have a useful conversation where you receive feedback and you're able to give feedback in a healthy way that it can actually bring you closer together versus just being stuck in your own perspective, you know, and it's not easy. Yeah. But it's totally worth the effort, you know?
I couldn't agree more. And this is something I talk about in my book about resolving issues, is that attitude which you're describing, which is that any problem that I have belongs to us. Any problem that you have belongs to us. Why? Because if we're in a relationship together, if you're unhappy, that's going to affect our relationship, and that's actually going to affect me. So you don't want to talk about problems as being my problem or your problem. If there's something that's not working in the relationship, that's a problem for both partners, and that's an us issue. You're a team, and you need to sit together and talk about how do we resolve that? How do we bring things together? So you're exactly right. This idea that it's all about my problems and what I want, that just doesn't work in a relationship. A relationship's a team effort, and basically it's about going, hey, if you're unhappy, that is my problem. And it's very specifically my problem, because if I'm in a relationship with you and you're unhappy, it means that I'm doing something that you don't like. How do we get around that? How do we work together on that so we can both be happy? So I couldn't agree with you more. And I think it's a big problem. And I think it's one of the reasons why divorce rates are so high, is that people have lost that ability to understand that it's not about me. It's actually about us.
Yeah. It's interesting in the context that we're living in, there's a big... You know, there's such a focus on this idea of sovereignty and interpersonal sovereignty. I think perhaps because the pendulum is swinging from where it was of total enmeshment, and now there is this hyper individuation even within romantic relationship. But my partner and I, we did something that a lot of people will laugh at first, but then we explain it and they're like, wow, that actually really makes a lot of sense. So a few years ago, we were talking about our relationship, and the idea came that, like, you know what, when we're together, it's not just you and me. It's this, like, we're creating something bigger than us. Like, the relationship is an entity, you know? So we named our relationship, actually, to put a name to it, to say, hey, what does the relationship need? You know, we called it we still call it this, but the Nimbus 3000, just because of Harry Potter. And so either one of us are upset, if either one of us are upset or, you know, sad or angry or whatever, we can do a check-in and say, hey, what does the Nimbus need? Like, what does the relationship need? And it's a really useful orientation switch from like, oh, Naima is mad or Taylor's mad or it's her problem or it's my problem. It's like, is there something in the field with both of us that we can collectively work on? And there is nuance to that too, because not every reason she's sad is my responsibility and vice versa, you know, but within the context of relationship, like, totally, there's a lot more crossover that's worth looking at.
I think that's brilliant because I'm so competitive. I'm going to go to my wife now. We're going to call our relationship the number 4,000. I'm just joking. Nice. I think that's a really good idea. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's where perhaps people in the modern day are losing a bit. And that is relationships are transcendent. So I think although you've done something in a sense that's figurative, it's actually literally true as well. Relationships are transcendent, and it is something bigger than each individual. And that's the beauty of it, is that you take two people who have different emotional needs, who have different sexual needs, who have different cultural baggages and emotional vulnerabilities and problems. And everyone has, you know, we're all human, and we all have, it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, the most famous person in the world, all of us have deficiencies and vulnerabilities and things that upset us. And two people, yeah, that two people can come together, overcome all of those differences, bond together, grow together, and survive all the vicissitudes of life, because life is not easy for anyone. Doesn't matter how rich you are, how famous you are, or how clever you are, you're going to have ups and downs. You're going to lose people you love. You're going to have relationship breakdowns. And within your own relationship, there are going to be times where things are tough, where you fight, where you have to pull through more difficult times, where you like each other a little bit more or a little bit less. And the fact that you can actually do that and stay together and still love each other and create this relationship where there's so much history and so much connection, that is actually transcendent. And so your relationship is, in a sense, the number 3,000. It's something a little bit greater than each individual. So I really like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing to explore and play with. Yeah. And we've gotten other friends to do it with their relationships too. And then we can ask them, what is your relationship need? Like, what is your fancy named relationship need? So question, because I know it's probably coming up for some people who are listening right now, like, when is an appropriate time to, do you believe that breaking up transitioning relationships ever is a useful thing? Just, you know, for the sake of conversation and devil's advocate, like, are you saying like we should always stay together forever because that's how true happiness is created?
No, absolutely not. I think if that was the case, then I would have married my 14-year-old girlfriend when I was 14, and that didn't happen, and she wouldn't have been the right person for me to be with forever. So I have a very simple way of dealing with this, which I call the right question. And the right question is a tool that I believe can answer any piece of advice. If someone wants advice from you, you ask them the right question. If you want to make a decision, you ask yourself the right question. And it's purely, what do I want and what am I willing to pay for it? And what that means is, when you're looking at a relationship that's not working, you need to ask yourself, but what do I want? You have to say, what do I want in this relationship? And if the answer to that question is what you want is not what your partner is giving you and not what they're willing to give you, then you probably, it is a good thing to break up. There are lots of relationships that are abusive or nasty, and then you really need to get out of there. If someone's an abusive person and they are not willing to change that, that's a time to get out. But even, I think that's the sort of far end of things where people are really unpleasant partners, then you definitely don't want to stick with them. But in the more subtle areas where people really are wondering, I love this person, but I just don't think this is working for me. Well, the first thing you need to ask yourself is, what isn't working? What do I want? What is my partner not giving me? What is this relationship not giving me? And there's a number of important aspects to that. The one is, if you can't work out what you want, then your partner's definitely not going to be able to give it to you. You need to actually know what you want. And a lot of people just become unhappy, and they're unhappy because they're actually expecting too much, or they want things that aren't realistic. Mm. So you need to actually take the time to crystallize what it is exactly you want out of your relationship. And then the next step is to actually communicate that with your partner. Or if you feel that you just simply can't get what you want, then maybe it is time to break up. But the second aspect of the question is, what am I willing to pay for it? Because there's also within that construct, you want certain things, but are you willing to give to the relationship what is required to get there? So you go, this is the end point I want to get to, but this is what I'd have to give to get there. So this idea of endless self-sacrifice, it may work for a few people, but for most people, the idea of just sacrificing yourself endlessly on the altar of your relationship is not actually a good construct. And if that's what your partner wants from you, so if your partner's saying to you, the price that you pay for being my partner are these things. And you look at that price and you go, I'm not willing to pay that. This relationship is too expensive. Then either your partner needs to change the price or you need to get out of there. And the other thing that can happen along the way is that you find that the amount of work that you're giving to the relationship is not giving you what you want. So in other words, you can't get what you want and you're paying too high a price all the time. So those are the things that I would use to decide whether to stay in a relationship. If you want to make it a logical thing is, you know, can you get what you want? What are those things? And if you can, how much are you going to have to put in? And if you're just endlessly exhausting yourself and getting very little in return, then that's not a great relationship to be in.
Totally. Totally. We should all take a deep breath to that. I'm going to do that and take a sip of water.
Well, it's kind of not a very exciting answer, but it's, I think, a practical one anyway.
I know. I think it's a great answer and super practical. And one thing you said really sticks out for me, and that is this piece around taking time to actually figure out what it is that you want. I think I can totally see this in my younger self in previous relationships where I didn't know what I wanted and I didn't take the time to figure it out, but I was existing in this place of not feeling happy or satisfied in my relationship. And I was blaming unconsciously my partner for that and unconsciously making her responsible for my happiness, when in fact, I just never took the time to actually figure out what it was that I wanted. I distracted myself with social media, distracted myself with porn, distracted myself with just too many social things, just distracted myself from all the things. And I think that's a super common thing too. Like, the, you know, I've talked to lots of guys who are like, they're not happy in a relationship, but they want something to be different. And then the question is like, well, what do you want? And then there's usually a long pause and they're like, huh, well, I think I want some more freedom or some, you know, they don't know. And it's a really good conversation to have at that point. Like, huh, interesting. So you're unhappy in your relationship and unhappy with your partner, but you don't actually know what you want. So let's explore that some more. I think I would just really want to encourage people to take some time to feel into that.
I like that very much because I think there's two things. The one is when you're giving advice, what you're doing there is asking them the right question. And mostly if you can convince someone to ask themselves the right question, they don't need your advice. So people come and ask your advice and you say, well, what do you actually want? Have you actually identified what you want? And what are you willing to pay for it? If they go, I don't know what I want, you say, well, go away and think about that because I can't give you advice. If you can't even tell me what you're looking for, how am I supposed to give you any advice? And usually once they've done that, they don't need advice anymore. But the second aspect of that is I think it's much easier to be unhappy than to be happy. How's that for a quotable quote? But it's easier to be unhappy than to be happy. Being happy takes work. Mm. You have to work hard in your relationship, to work hard in your sex life. You have to work hard in life to be happy. And that's one of the reasons why social media has been so effective. It's told everyone, why bother to be happy when you can be angry and unhappy? It's really easy and everyone else is doing it as well. So I think that's a real challenge for the world is to understand actually happiness takes hard work.
Yeah. And I think also useful to, making a little note here on the side, also useful to clarify, like, what does that actually mean, happiness? Does that mean you're generally all day, you're just full of bliss and you're having this amazing, joyous experience constantly? I would argue no, but I would argue that happiness on a different level is, and I'm curious to hear your perspective, but it's this more sort of like there's a grounded internal satisfaction and meaningfulness of life and a overall good foundational feeling that you're living the life that you want to be living, even though it takes work. And even though at times you might be sad or frustrated, but there's like a different flavor than just this sort of like surface level floating around airy happiness that gets projected around a lot. I'm curious to hear your perspective on that. Like, what does actually happiness mean to you in that context?
I think that's a brilliant question because it's sort of the fundamental question, isn't it, for human beings is what is happiness and how do you become happy? So looking at evidence, long-term relationships and being part of a community makes people happy. But if we're all addicted to instant gratification and we live in bodies that genetically code for acquisition and getting what we want, and your body's actually designed for energy conservation. So you're actually genetically designed to try and get whatever you want as easily as possible to conserve energy. And so that's what we do. We try and go for instant gratification. But we all know deep down that people who are are rock stars are not happy. Not that any they're no happy rock stars, but what I mean is people who sleep around with 1,000 people, they can have whatever they want, they've got endless money, they take drugs, they drink alcohol, whatever they want in the moment they have. Those people are never happy. So which famous people are happy? Well, the ones that are in long-term happy relationships. And you can look at you can look around you, and that's true. And so what does that teach us about life? It's that existential happiness really does come from hard work. So what makes you happy existentially is challenging yourself, working hard, and achieving goals where you at the end point feel that you've extended yourself as best as you can, you've grown through the process, and you really feel like, wow, I've got somewhere, I'm improving, I'm getting better. I'm in this relationship with this man or woman or in this marriage, and we've worked for 20 years on making this relationship work, and we actually enjoy spending time together and the relationship works. That's very existentially satisfying. Having sex with someone is super, super satisfying in the moment, but having sex with 100 different people on 100 days, at the end of all of that, are those people truly happy? Usually, ultimately not. And that's based on actual evidence. Hedonism is what our bodies tell us we want. But in truth, it isn't actually what makes human beings happy. So what makes human beings happy is really working hard and achieving worthwhile goals in life, which sounds very very strange, but it is what makes people happy.
Totally. Yeah. And I just want to put a plug in here too, because I do think there is room and space for like meaningful, happy, beautiful, more casual sexual experiences. I think you're obviously talking about the more extreme end of that. And I've been there too, like, oh, having mindless sex and ultimately realizing, well, this actually isn't solving any of my issues. It feels good. I get the neurotransmitter hit of sex with the person, but ultimately at my core, it's not fulfilling that which I really desire. But in the process, it was helpful for me to do those things to get to that point. But you said a couple things about comfort, and I just wanted to give a shout out to
I just want to add in, certainly I'm not speaking out against people having lots of sex, which I think is awesome and definitely does make people happy. But I think the difficulty is that ultimately most people to find happiness need to find a meaningful other in their lives. And however much casual sex they have along the way, if they don't find that meaningful other, life's actually pretty lonely. It's having that shared connection usually that makes people happy. So I'm definitely not putting down enjoying sex, which is very healthy and fun for most people, hopefully.
Totally. Yeah. And sorry, if you're
getting
listening
on to
and
another
you don't,
point and I interrupted you.
No, I have a note in front of me. I'll get there. But I just want to say, like, also, if you're listening and you don't have a significant romantic other, you're not doomed. You're not damned, because there is research also that says like quality close friendships can do a lot of that too. And quality close community can do a lot of that too. And also relying entirely on one romantic partner for that is actually really problematic and unhealthy as well. So like diversification of needs is super important. I want to give a shout out to a book. Yeah. Awesome.
I'm happy to endorse that point. I wasn't meaning to be so I'm just saying that really relationships, building relationships with people, it doesn't have to be one person, but it's finding people you can. I was actually giving a tutorial last night to doctors on what makes people happy in the workplace. And one of the evidence-based things is having a good friend at work. And we were talking about the fact that whether it is your colleagues or your partner or a group of colleagues, you really need to have people in your life that you can share the good times and the bad times with, because that's actually what brings meaning to those good and bad times. So I completely agree with you. It doesn't have to be one person. It doesn't have to just be a marriage, but definitely it's about investing in relationships working.
Totally. Yeah. So tonight, just another personal anecdote, I'm going to go, well, I'll say this, that has become really important to me within the last year or two, like realizing how much I actually want to invest in different interpersonal relationships, because it was easy for me to get sort of like hyper individually focused when I was really building my business. And now I'm like, whoa, actually that was a little isolating. I need connection. So tonight I'm going to go hang out with a couple guys specifically to go into a sauna and then cold plunge in a river back and forth and talk about like the deep stuff in life. And that's super meaningful for me and helps me feel happy too. And just want to encourage people to have those kinds of relationships as well. But on that note, you said something about comfort. I don't remember exactly what you said, but just to throw this out there too, there's another book that I don't know if you're familiar with, but you'd probably enjoy. It's called The Comfort Crisis. Have you heard of that?
I haven't, no.
It's super, super interesting. Basically, the idea is just like, we're so comfortable in society that we're not actually pushing ourselves and therefore we're not happy. And like you just said, like happiness is the result of hard work, and we're in a society in a context that we arguably don't have to work nearly as hard as our ancestors did, not even close, you know? And so, yeah, just how can you actually step into the challenge of creating the life that you really want? That's an invitational question that I like to ask. And that's
fantastic.
Today.
That's actually very interesting. Firstly, just to say that there's actually good evidence that jumping into saunas and then into cold water and back into saunas is actually life prolonging. I don't do it myself because it sounds a bit painful, but actually, there's actually evidence that intermittent fasting and jumping in and out of saunas is actually good for people, and somehow shocking your metabolism, it creates epigenetic shift that actually prolongs life. I'm just into having coffee every day, so I don't want to do intermittent fasting myself. So coming back to your point, that's a very fascinating idea that if things become too comfortable, people stop innovating, because of course, when people need to change things, they need to innovate, they do. So people are very creative when they need to change things to survive, or they really need something, they'll be creative. And so when people just get everything they want all the time, humans stop being creative, they stagnate. And interestingly, that was a theme that was explored in Isaac Asimov's books. I don't know if you've heard of Isaac Asimov, he was rated as one of the three greatest science fiction authors of all time. So thematically, he was very strongly in agreement with you. What he wrote about was the fact that when people have robots doing everything for them, you can get robots to clean your house and to make your coffee and to cook for you and to do everything for you, which is sort of the ultimate expression of AI, then people become completely complacent. They lie around. They don't have to do anything. And humanity stagnates. So in his books, people colonize space, but people on Earth ban robots because they recognize how bad that level of technological comfort is for people, that people just stop caring to do anything. So I think
interesting.
That's a very interesting theme to think about.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. I'll check out those books. Thanks for that. Man, what a interesting conversation. I didn't think it was going to go this direction, but I'm glad it did. Cause I have some thought provoking things that I'm going to keep thinking about going on from here. So thank you. Thanks for all the insights and the reflections. I'm curious, is there anything else while we're coming to the end here that you feel like, oh, I want to say this piece to add in or to make sure this kind of creates a whole picture of everything that we've talked about?
Well, firstly, we didn't talk much about sex, which was quite interesting, but that's all good.
No, we didn't.
So we didn't upgrade sex that much. But I just want to say that philosophically, it's sad to me that the world has gone away from being happy and from I think relationships are beautiful, and whether it's men and women falling in love, men and men, women and women, whoever, relationships are something beautiful. Falling in love is something beautiful. The book that I wrote is actually about heterosexual relationships because I happen to be heterosexual, and so it's my area of expertise. I can't write about other things because I don't know about them. But I think that we live in a world now where people have lost the idea that actually men and women falling in love is something beautiful. Humans falling in love is something beautiful. Having children is something beautiful. Mm-hmm. These are not things that we should put all this negativity into the space. I think having masculine men and feminine women is beautiful. And if you have masculine women and feminine men, that's also fine. But I think that people have become so politicized about all these issues that they've lost the idea that actually many heterosexual couples are very happy that the masculine and feminine attract each other. And that if you're different to that, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But we don't also have to demonize that. And so that was really what I wrote my book about, was to you know, give a humorous account of what it's like to be, for most marriages, and why it's actually funny that men and women are often different and have different needs. And I think the positivity is what we want to see back in society, that, you know, actually, it's a beautiful world. Falling in love, having kids, that's something amazing and magic. And we should rather be happy than sort of dividing up and being angry with each other.
Yeah. What's the title of your book?
Women Are Superior to Men.
Ha, nice.
But it's a tongue-in-cheek title. It's actually not a sexist book. It's not really saying that women are superior to men. What it really is about is the ways that my wife is superior to me, and then discussing why those physiological differences exist between us. So there's differences in male and female physiology and genetics and evolution, and why couples commonly fight about those kinds of issues. So it's really not a sexist book at all, I promise.
Awesome. Well, we'll put that into the link of the show notes. We'll put your website and how to contact you into the link of the show notes. And just to say also, you said we didn't upgrade sex so much, but to me, I think we really did. Like sex doesn't exist in a vacuum. I think that's one of the biggest illusions of modern society, is we think, oh, sex lives in this little isolated box down in our genitals, not impacted by the context of the world. But everything we talked about impacts sex and desire in the context of relationship and in the context of just being alone. So to me, that all relates and it's all impactful. And I think, yeah, I just wanted to name that. So thank you.
You're absolutely right about that. And thanks for having me on the show. It's been a real honor and a real privilege. I've enjoyed your company.
Yeah, same to you. And if you're listening, thank you for being here. If you have any questions or comments, please leave a comment on the YouTube version of this, because it's helpful to have all that in one place and I can go there and respond to you, share resources or whatever. And yeah, thank you, Ricky, again. It's been a pleasure. Hope you have a beautiful rest of your day. And thank you, listener. I hope you have a beautiful rest of your day, and I'll see you in the next episode.